Okay, thanks a lot. Nice to see you all again. And we're continuing through Mark's Gospel. Just a reminder, we've got this week and one more. Just let someone in. So two sessions to try and finish the remaining chapters of Mark. So we obviously continue to go at quite a pace. We may not, as before, cover every little incident and episode in quite the same detail. But the aim would be today, starting from chapter 11, which is where we got up to, probably to do three chapters. 11, 12, 13, and leave the other three till next week. It's interesting that, I might have said this earlier, but by the time you get to chapter 11, and in a moment, we'll just look at the opening few verses of it, you've now reached the final six chapters, and this is the last week of Jesus's life. So the whole of the gospel has been coming up to this point, and the remaining 38% of it is about the last week of Jesus's life. And it's the same in the other Gospels. In Matthew, it's 29%. Just let someone else in.
I'll do it.
In Luke, it's 23%. In John, it's 45%. So overall, in all the Gospels, 29 out of the 80 chapters is from what we're looking at today and next week to the end. That's 36%. So obviously, all the rest of the stuff's important, but it's been heading towards this great climax of the death and resurrection of Jesus. So we're going to start in Matthew 11, and I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to read the first 11 verses. So it's the well-known Palm Sunday story. So Mark 11, let me say it again, Mark 11 verses 1 to 11, but you might have got time to check it out because it's in all of them. So if you want to know where else to find it, it's the opening verses of Matthew chapter 21. It's in Luke chapter 19, starting at verse 28. And it's also in John chapter 12, verses 12 to 15. So we'll focus obviously on Mark 11, 1 to 11, but you might like to have at least one of those open as well, in case there's always something extra to bring from elsewhere. So that was Matthew 21, 1 to 9, Luke 19, 28 to 38, John 12, verses 12 to 15. So about 3 minutes, perhaps, just to remind yourself of that and double check with another gospel if you want. So we'll pick things up in 3 minutes. All right, so let's start looking at this together then, get some comments from you in a moment. One of the things that I want to sort of ask, put out there, is why did Jesus do it this way? And why did he do it on that day? So why enter Jerusalem that way and on that day? It was clearly something very well planned and prepared. And he sent two disciples into a village and said, "We'll find all this, just get on with it, get it going." He planned it for that time. He planned it in that way. So what would you think was going on? And a little question that relates to that is, we call this Palm Sunday. Why was it? Do you think it was a Sunday? Does it give you any indication that it was on what we now call a Sunday? Because unless I've missed something, I can't actually find anywhere that explains that it was a Sunday. Do we just put it on a Sunday because it suits our services and so on? Mary?
Well, wasn't that the 10th of Nisan when the lamb had to be checked over?
Yeah.
And decide, and they had to look at it for 5 days to check that it wasn't perfect.
You're absolutely right. I'm going to come on to that, as that's why I've asked the question about what was actually happening, why that day. But let me ask you this then. If that was the 10th of Nisan, what day was the 14th of Nisan?
Well, that's a thing for debate. I don't think it was Friday when he died. I think it may have been Wednesday or Thursday.
Well, yeah, but what I'm asking you to do is to do the counting and do the maths, if you like. If Palm Sunday, if it's Sunday,
the 10th of Nisan.
The 10th, if you count ahead, the 14th will be.
That's the fifth day, the 10, 11, 12, 13, 14th. So they had to check.
Yeah, so which day of the week would the 14th be?
Well, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, but that.
No, 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 you counted too many.
Thursday.
Yeah. So, if you want the Palm Sunday to be on a Sunday, then you've got to have the 14th on a Thursday. If you want the 14th to be on a Friday, then Palm Sunday has got to be on Palm Monday. That's not too complicated.
Right.
Now, you've jumped ahead into something that we're going to look at eventually, obviously with the question of, well, does it really matter? But we'll say now that the idea that the crucifixion was on a Friday is purely tradition.
Correct.
Okay. But the only day on which I think we can establish anything like that is when we come to the resurrection, and it was the first day of the week, early on the first day of the week.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because it was the day after the Sabbath, after Passover.
Indeed. But remember, there had been other Sabbaths around as well. So a Sabbath doesn't have to be a Saturday, does it? There are lots of other Sabbaths that go with these feasts. So again, you're quite right that Sabbath would have been a Saturday Sabbath, but it could also have been another Sabbath before then. You can have two Sabbaths next to each other, can't you, consecutive days under those circumstances. Anyway, let's see what other people have got to say, either into this already interesting argument.
It was prophesied in Zechariah about them riding in a colt.
Yeah. Okay, so that you're answering back my other question now about why in that particular way. Yeah, okay. John or Rose?
Yeah, just to say that it probably wasn't the Saturday, that he was going in, because folk were round about and busy. And I'm not sure if it's too far distance-wise, but it's probably about okay, I suspect, to go from Bethany. But other folk might have gone further. So it was a busy day. It was a normal weekday rather than a Sabbath day. So it couldn't have been the Saturday. So
yeah, I agree with that.
But the other thing about Sabbaths is that I think crucifixion day, the Passover day was a large, what do they call it? A large Sabbath? No.
A great Sabbath,
which means it was a double. So it was an ordinary Sabbath plus the feast on the same day, meaning that the Sabbath itself was the Friday evening into Saturday.
Okay, I don't come across the idea. And I'm still not quite sure what you mean, that one day is a bigger Sabbath than another.
Well, when two Sabbaths coincide.
Oh, I see what you mean.
The normal Sabbath, or whatever, you know, the weekly normal Sabbath, plus another Sabbath, i.e. Okay. One of the appointed.
So I've got you now. You mean a 48-hour Sabbath?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's then called a great Sabbath, which means that. And I think somewhere, can't remember where now, I remember somebody talking to us about it, that actually it's designated as a great Sabbath,
this
particular one, and therefore the two things coincided. That's the suggestion.
Okay.
But if you do the counting, as Mary has said, you come somewhere else.
Yeah, and just going back to what you said earlier, obviously, whatever Palm Sunday was, it wasn't Palm Saturday. Otherwise, you're going to have the crucifixion then on the Wednesday, and it's really getting a bit too early to make sense. Anyway, Alison?
I was just going to say that Shabbat Gadol, the Great Sabbath, is now always counted the Shabbat before Pesach, before Passover, whether it's consecutive or not. It's just what that Shabbat is called, the one before Passover.
Yes, when you say before, you mean not necessarily the day before.
No, any time. So if Pesach is on Monday, then the Friday, Saturday before is still Shabbat Gadol. If it's on Wednesday, the Friday, Saturday before is still Shabbat Gadol.
All right. So you're saying that there's always a I'm going to call it double Sabbath, so I understand it better. So there's always a double Sabbath.
No. Just this term, the Great Sabbath, the Shabbat Gadol.
Yeah.
Because Gadol is big, isn't it? Is that Shabbat before Pesach, but it doesn't have to be consecutive with it. It's just what they call the Shabbat before Pesach.
So it's still a 24-hour Sabbath?
It's still just a normal Sabbath. The normal
Okay, got you now, got you. And I was trying to work out, because when you were saying 2 days, I know that Sabbath really is a Friday to a Saturday because it's sundown and so on, but I wasn't sure whether you were calling it 2 days.
24-hour Shabbat is...
Okay, okay.
Yeah, but I don't know the same then. But that's what we do.
Okay. So, Elizabeth?
I hadn't heard of Great Sabbath. I thought it was one of their special Sabbaths that they had as a was it the Feast of Unleavened Bread?
Yes. So that's another point. And by the way, someone in the chat, I think it was Lisa, has put that it might be called a High Sabbath. That's what I understand sometimes the Sabbath is known, when it's a special feast Sabbath, not a Saturday and so on. But yeah, unleavened bread began with a Sabbath and ended with a Sabbath. Mm. So, and that's on the first and seventh days. So they can't both be Saturdays anyway.
So, but just to quickly say that quite a few people do work out that the crucifixion was on a Wednesday. So, and I'm not sure, but I've done a bit of research.
Yeah,
to confirm that.
I've done quite a bit of research, and I find it very difficult to stretch it to a Wednesday.
Okay.
Equally, I find it difficult to think of it as a Friday. I was going to leave that till sort of next week when we actually get to those particular events and talk about some of the aspects there. But it is relevant to the fact that we're now starting this final week.
Mm.
And that question that I've been asking, which is, why that way and why that day? Now, someone's already mentioned, I think it's Mary, mentioned about the 10th of Nisan. Perhaps we better turn to that. In case you're not familiar with this, you need Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12 and the first six verses. So I better give you a minute to find Exodus 12, verses 1 to 6, and just read through those. And we'll talk a bit more about that. I mean, while you're reading it, just to pick up the main point, is that they chose the particular lamb, or you notice it could be a kid. It was perfectly possible to take a goat, apparently, rather than a lamb. But on the 10th day of this month being the first month, which is now known as Nisan, if occasionally you find in your scriptures it's called Abib, that was an earlier name. I think there was a sort of Babylonian name and a Jewish name or something for it, but it's the same month. And they have to take it, well, it doesn't actually say so here, but usually they then took it into the house for the 4 days until the twilight of the 14th day when it would be slaughtered. So if for some reason Jesus is reenacting the selection of the Passover lamb on that same day that he is riding in, then in a few moments we will look at the consequences of that in terms of what happened to the Passover lamb there and what happened to Jesus. But the other key verse in Exodus 12 is that verse 6, take care of them, each household with its own particular lamb or kid, or maybe shared if they couldn't afford one. Take care of it. So why did they have to take care of it, do you think, for those 4 days?
So
Mary or, no, someone.
So it wouldn't have a defect.
Yes. Mm. Mary, are you going to add something there?
I heard this young man, a Jewish young man, talking about this lamb that they took in to their family, really. Mm. And it stayed with them, and the children started to love it and everything.
Mm.
So it indeed was, when the lamb had to be killed, it was a real sacrifice.
Yeah, and I think that's what's come up in the chat there, that it doesn't quite become the family pet, but it does become something more than just, yeah, I've gone out in the field and grabbed it.
That's right.
But this business about it being without blemish and defect is important, because if you want to be absolutely sure, you better make sure that when it comes into the house, therefore, it's looked after and it doesn't sort of fall over or go into a ditch or something. And then you've got to start all over again and you're struggling to find one. So you check it out at the beginning to make sure it's okay. So it gets sort of pre-selected. And then by looking after it, you make sure that it's still in that same good condition by the time you come to the 14th. So we'll come back to that point in a moment. We've got John and Jan.
It's also the right age to be rather rampant.
Yes, yes.
Testosterone filled, so might well kick the tables over in the house.
Indeed. It may wonder quite why it's there and what's going to happen, and I don't know whether it's looking at the calendar and deciding I've only got four more days to go. But yeah, taking a one-year-old sheep, therefore a ram, into the house, it would be quite a challenge. And I suppose you've also been told that 1 year old in sheep terms is about 30 years old in human terms, you know, mature adult male. Another interesting little thing on this. All this is based upon the fact that John the Baptist said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." And you remember Paul in 1 Corinthians talks about our Passover lamb has been sacrificed. So it's Jesus is going to be our Passover lamb. It's not just because of his death and so on. It's going to include everything about it that he has to be at that point. Yeah, Lisa?
It's interesting you say about the one-year-old lamb being like an equivalent to a 30-year-old man, because wasn't he meant to be around his 30s when he passed away?
That's one of the reasons why I was saying it, yes, because, you know, it is the equivalent of the sort of age that Jesus was at that time. The other point, of course, about particularly trying to work out the days is that we don't actually know the year in which this happened. Just like we don't quite know when Jesus was born, we don't quite know the year. You'll find good cases made, I think, for the 29, AD 29 or 30. Some even push it to 33. But sometimes I find the arguments a bit circular, in the sense of it must be that year, so the days match, or the other way round, that let's make the days match and then find which way around the year should be. And I'm not sure in the end we're meant to fully know exactly which year. And therefore, we know what the dates within the Jewish calendar were. But one of the reasons we can't necessarily match them up is that you would have to know which year you're in. And even that might be subject to a little bit of variation. Anyway, John and Jan again.
Sorry, I heard somewhere that Jesus went in by the sheep gate.
Oh, okay. Do you know where that is?
No, I was going to ask which book that's in.
I think it's towards the south. Trying to remember my Nehemiah stuff. I think when Nehemiah started his inspection, he started at the sheep gate, and it would be from the south. But I always thought that he came in from the east on that. But again, maybe that's another tradition. Yeah. That's...
I heard some teaching that showed that he entered by the same gate that the temple lambs would have been brought through.
Yeah, and that was presumably the sheep gate.
It was which of the Gospels mentions it, I was asking.
What mentions the sheep gate? Which Gospel? I don't think it mentions a gate, does it? I can't remember. I don't know whether you read any of the other Matthew, Luke and John versions, but I don't think it particularly mentioned it. But so we're coming back to Mary again.
You're muted, Mary.
I understood that Jesus came through the gate that Suleiman later closed.
The Golden Gate, the Messiah Gate, effectively. Yeah, that's another one. Again, whether it's got enough evidence or whether it's just the right sort of idea, it could be either of those. There's a lot of, what shall I call it, mystery, unknowns about Easter, and I think that's good. Just like there's lots of other things, it keeps us, you know, sort of wondering and not trying to overanalyze things, just thinking, oh, it could be that, it could be that. In the end, what really matters is what we really know about rather than what it might have been here and might have been there. So basically, does it really matter which day of the week the crucifixion was? No, not in terms of, you know, theology, salvation and all the rest of it. It would be nice to know, perhaps, and maybe there's good reasons for different options. But in the end, we're not going to fight about it, are we? John and Rose?
Yeah, Rose has found a map with gates listed on it.
Okay.
And the sheep gate is straight north.
North?
Mm-hmm.
What, yeah, near the temple?
Yeah.
Of course, it would be, wouldn't it, near the temple, yeah.
Mm.
Okay. All right, I must have my map upside down when I'm looking at it, yeah. Okay. Anyway, we don't know it was that gate, but it would necessarily make sense, yeah. Now, coming back to the why this way and why this day, we've already dug into it a little bit. Someone's also mentioned that it does fulfil Zechariah 9:9, not suggesting that Jesus was going out of his way to make sure that every piece of prophecy was, you know, sort of ticked off and so on. But another interesting, this is a fact that would go with this, is that this wasn't the only procession that would come into Jerusalem at this time of year. Anyone heard about that and know what I'm referring to? No, okay, good.
Be something you've new spoken there. About it before, Paul.
Have you? Have I?
You have, yes.
And you've remembered it.
I couldn't remember too much, though.
Okay. The other thing, of course, is I meant to say this first. Do you remember the Maccabees and the time when they rode into Jerusalem, having defeated Antiochus Epiphanes, and there's a lot of shouting and palm waving and all the rest of it? It is recorded in the book of Maccabees. Maccabees, that was about 100 and nearly 200 years earlier than Jesus, another sort of victory parade. So in some ways, were they reenacting that? The people, that is. I'm not saying that Jesus was trying to do that. It wasn't a sort of anniversary of that. But the other point I was getting to is that at some point around this time, may have been the same day, may not be absolutely sure, is that Pilate would come into Jerusalem with his... would come into Jerusalem with a column or so of the Roman army, because they reinforced the garrison there at the time of Passover, simply because of, well, two reasons. One, the huge amount of people there, but also because the nature of Passover was one of great emotion. It was a time of celebration of freedom. It was about the time when the Jews were liberated from a major imperial power, Egypt, and the Romans understood all that, would get a bit twitchy, so in they would come, this time from the west. So whether you want Jesus coming in from the east, the north, whatever, it doesn't matter, but from the west in would come a big Roman column of soldiers to go and reinforce the Fortress Antonia near the temple. Pilate didn't live in Jerusalem, okay? He had a much nicer place to live on the coast, a place called Caesarea Maritima, a fairly new city, about 60 miles from Jerusalem. That's where he lived most of the time. But of course, as governor, he would come into the city at various times with a show of power, of strength. And it's a big parade, and a bit like you see sometimes military parades in various countries on certain dates of the year, just to show off what sort of power you've actually got. So it might have been that there was a contrast going on here between the worldly kingdom, if you like, of the Romans and all they stood for, power, might, ruthlessness and so on, and Jesus coming in a completely different way. But what Jesus wasn't coming in to do was to be hailed really as a particular threat. He was coming in order to die. So he knew straight away that what was in his heart and all this. The people might have decided otherwise and reminisced about the Maccabees or wanted to see the Romans dealt with and so on. But Jesus had a totally different agenda, but he might have been doing something. That why the stage managed? Is that why that particular day was chosen? Did it coincide with the day of the Romans coming in or whatever? So the people basically had a choice of which procession to go and cheer. John and Rose?
Maybe doesn't matter that much, but if one is coming from Bethany and the Mount of Olives, the beautiful gate is the nearest.
Well, what we know is that from this point, this is part of what I'm saying, is that Jesus comes in on that particular day and he doesn't stay very long, does he? Did you notice that? That he has a look round and it was already late. So out he goes to Bethany, where he's going to stay the night with presumably Mary and Martha. My point again of why does he do that on that day is that when he comes back the next day and the next day and the next day, however many more days it is, he never rides in on a donkey again. They don't hail him in that particular way. He's come in, he's done that. And then after that, he just seems to go backwards and forwards over the mountain, Mount of Olives, on a daily basis without trying to create the same sort of stir and acclaim. So, Elizabeth?
I just wondered, in the Luke's version, it says that this donkey had never been ridden before. Yeah. Do you think that there's any significance in that? Or?
Well, it might be. And in Matthew's version, you've got the fact that Anne Mother came too, because there's two animals taken. And you would bring the mother as well if the colt hadn't been ridden before. And if the colt hadn't been ridden before, it wouldn't have experienced the sort of crowds and the sort of noise and all the other stuff. And it might have been very scared. People make the significance of, Jesus being Jesus, he could control the donkey, even if it was, brand new, if you like, the colt, and might otherwise have been scared. But the other point that's often made is that the mother was brought along as well, so that both the mother and the colt were not sort of too distressed by it. Mm-hmm. We'll leave that to the animal experts to decide how much that might be true. Mary again?
Well, I've heard a teaching about the colt and its mother. And excuse me if I'm getting mixed up, but if you go back to Exodus, all the those who came through the womb first, the firstborn, belong to God, animals as well as human beings. And this colt obviously was a firstborn, but they had to, because the firstborn belonged to God, if you read in Exodus, they had to give that particular firstborn to God, but not a donkey.
Not a donkey. Oh, I see.
Not a donkey. And the interesting thing is, if I've got this right, the donkey had to be redeemed by a lamb.
Oh.
And so when the donkey came into Jerusalem, this was this firstborn donkey, or colt, being redeemed.
Yeah,
by the Lamb of God.
Yeah. Well, there we are. Can I leave that as sort of extra research for the keen students in the days to come? That's worth checking out.
Sure. Actually, I found it absolutely moving when I heard that.
Yeah. There's lots of things like this. When you hear something extra like that for the first time on top of familiar stories, it really does resonate, doesn't it? It really does give you an extra sense of, oh, wow, that's what it was all about and so on. Anyway, we spent a long time on that particular story, partly because it is well known and because I think there are various aspects of it that we've mentioned. I'm going to jump around a little bit because I want to pick up again the idea of, if this was the 10th of Nisan and Jesus has now been brought into the house i.e. the temple area, from this point onwards, then that meant that from the point of view of the Lamb in Exodus, there's now no going back. Okay, he has been selected. This is it. So that would be the same with Jesus. This now has to be the time when he's going. This is going to be the Passover in particular that he's going to be sacrificed for us. But if it was taken in to be examined, then a lot of what happens in the next few days would relate to that particular aspect of checking out that the lamb was a fit sacrifice. So I don't know whether anybody, maybe Mary has already started on this, knows any more about that before I go through it. So the examination or inspection of Jesus as our Passover lamb that's going to happen. Mary, if you want to say something, you're muted again.
If he was to be tested, and he was tested, and then Pilate declared him to be sinless.
Yes. Okay. So that's later on at the trial.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm talking about let's say it was Palm Sunday. What about the Monday, the Tuesday, the Wednesday? Having said that there's so many verses, such a big percentage of the gospel from Palm Sunday onwards, we tend to, when we're thinking about Easter, skip straight from Palm Sunday to the Last Supper. But we've got some interesting days in between.
Yeah.
And something you could do, an extra exercise, is make a note of every single incident that's recorded in the four gospels between Palm Sunday that we just read and the Last Supper. And there's lots and lots of different things that are recorded there, all very familiar. But if you were to say to most people, oh, there's this incident and that incident, they probably wouldn't know that it occurred in that week. Okay, mm-hmm. So it's worth having a list of things where you say, oh, yes, that happened within that week rather than, you know, months earlier and so on. So, for instance, we've got, I've just turned over at random, the widow's offering and so on. We all know that Jesus watched the widow put in the two mites and so on. We all know the teaching about it and so on. But did we know that that occurs within this period? Because that might make it more significant. But there are certain things that happen in this period which are more significant under the idea of the testing of the lamb. Now, I quite agree that when we come to the trial, and in particular the mistreatment of Jesus at the trial, which I'm leaving till next time, really, because it's in the later part of this, that's a whole new kind of testing. And again, Jesus had to remain perfect and sinless in the light of that. Because I think most of us, the way he was treated in terms of being hit and mocked and spat upon, most of us would have not reacted like Jesus. But he had to, you know, remain spotless in that. So the incidents within these chapters that constitute the testing of Jesus would be, for instance, in Mark 11, verse 27, would be the first one. And again, there's examples in Matthew and Luke to go with it. This was on the matter of authority. Okay, by what authority you're doing these things? Who gave you the authority to do this? Big issue, authority. And you notice that this test is from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders, who will basically want to know, almost like, this teaching you've got, where have you got it from? And because he's already done other things, like he's cleared out the temple courts, they're bound to approach him and say, why have you done this? Who's told you to do it? Or whose authority you're acting upon? But any sort of traveling rabbi teacher who would turn up to feast day, feast time, and set up stall in the temple area in order to teach people, would come under the scrutiny of those that are already there, the teachers of the law, the elders, the chief priests already there, to want to basically know, okay, are you teaching the right stuff? Which rabbi are you teaching from? And so on. So they challenge Jesus in this way, and you probably know the story very well, there from verse 29. Jesus answers their question with a question of his own, and he basically throws it back to them. John's baptism, what John taught, what about his authority? What do you make of that? Did he get that from God or did he get it from men? Was he doing his own thing or was heaven behind it? And if you remember the story, they really can't make up their mind because they're trapped either way. They say one thing or the other, then they're going to be criticized. So because they can't answer Jesus basically says, well, okay, I'm not going to tell you my answer then. And they walk away and they leave him. So he's got out of a tricky test or situation by a very clever counter question and basically challenging the people in Jerusalem there, what they made of John the Baptist. There's another test coming up in chapter 12 and verse 13 about paying tax to Caesar. Okay. And this time, the people that come to him, and I don't know if it's the same day or whether we now move on to the Tuesday or whatever, it doesn't really matter. But this time, it's the Pharisees and the Herodians. So we've got different groups of people each time turning up. What do you make of the fact that it's the Pharisees and the Herodians at this point? Anything? Does that mean anything to you? So we've got Mary again, yeah.
Well, I heard that the Herodians hated the Pharisees and vice versa, but they came together because they had one aim to get rid of Jesus.
Exactly. They were opposites. We call them opposites politically. The Pharisees didn't like the rule of Herod. Okay, they were against anything like that. The Herodians, obviously, were supporters of Herod. So they did not like each other, so on. So the fact that they come together at this point for the same purpose is quite significant. And they flatter Jesus and say, oh, we know you're a man of integrity, you aren't swayed by others, blah, blah, blah. Oh, by the way, this tax to Caesar, pay it or not? Now, what you need to realise about this, I've got poll tax in my translation, it's a bit strange. This is a different sort of tax to what we're used to. This is in other versions, and I think mainly perhaps in Luke, it's better translated as tribute money. It was special coins that you used to pay tribute to Caesar. I've heard various things about that, but it's where you would go and you'd use that money to buy the incense that you had to put on the altar when you said Caesar is Lord, or when you sort of bowed down to Caesar. So the issue of, it's not about do you pay your taxes and so on. It's do you use your money to effectively worship Caesar and declare him to be the Lord of them all? Should we pay or shouldn't we? Now, the Herodians probably would be fine with it. The Pharisees, of course, would say, no, you shouldn't, because God is your king, your Lord, and so on. So it was a real sort of hot potato of the time, and therefore Jesus knows, why are you trying to trap me? Now, he gets out of it in a very interesting way. Firstly, you tell me what you think is going on with what he then did. How does he end up getting out of this? We've got John and Rose, but Elizabeth as well, I think. Elizabeth, do you want to say something first while you're unmuted?
I don't know if it's just obvious, but the portrait, you know, was Caesar.
Yeah.
So he said, give to Caesar what is.
Yeah. But before Caesar. Then. Yeah, you're right. But no, there's something before then I want you to pick up. John, Rose?
I was just thinking it was either spiritual or worldly, but.
Okay.
That wasn't what you were after.
Well, it's what he asks. He says, bring me you might have got the word denarius, but bring me one of these coins and let me look at it. Well, didn't you know what it looked like? Why bring me one? You see, neither the Pharisees nor the Herodians would be carrying this kind of coin around with them. Because remember where they are, they're on the Temple Mount. And you weren't allowed to have that kind of money on the Temple Mount. And anyway, they wouldn't, because you change your money. That's why there are money changers. So bring me one. They wouldn't have one immediately with them. So they'd probably have to go to the money changers and say, oh, can you just lend me this for a minute? I've got to do this sort of thing. Which is an interesting delaying tactic. It takes the sting out of the immediate situation. It's go and fetch me one of these coins and let me look at it. They bring the coin and Jesus doesn't look at it, doesn't touch it, doesn't do anything. Of course he doesn't, he knows exactly what's on it, but he wants to make the point, he wants the object in front of them, and they say he's probably delayed. Can you imagine there's a large crowd gathered around as well? Mm-hmm. Because everyone's interested in what he's going to do here. What's he going to say? So they bring the coin, and then he says, whose image is it? They all knew that, you know, hypothetical question. Whose inscription is it? Probably one that actually declares Caesar to be Lord or something about him in that sort of way. So they've established that. And then comes the bit that everybody knows about. Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. Has he actually answered their question about do we pay it or not? Is there an answer wrapped up in that statement to their initial question, or has he completely sidestepped it again? What do you think is going on in what he said? Mary, you're muted again. Coming in, yeah.
I would say he has answered it.
What, with a yes or a no?
Pay the tax.
You're saying pay give it, okay.
Give to Caesar what's his.
Yeah, so actually he's not saying you can't use the tribute coin for this way, but it's the fact that he adds something extra as well, because he's talked about image, okay? So if it's got Caesar's head on it, well, it's his, isn't it? You can let him have it. But he's not saying that you worship Caesar at the same time, because he adds give to God what is God's. What has the image of God stamped on it?
Every one of us.
Human beings, yeah. So he's actually challenging them, basically, don't care too much what you do with your money, as long as God gets you, okay? As long as you, if you get your priorities right. So he has sort of sidestepped the question, or at least he hasn't fallen into the trap of a blatant yes or a blatant no, which is going to upset half the people that are there, because as we say, he was going to disturb either the Pharisee or the Herodian, whichever way around he came on that. But they were amazed at him because he'd given that kind of answer, which, yes, you might say, he's still saying, it's okay if it's Caesar's coin, give it to Caesar, but it's what you do with yourself that's more important, what's in your heart. But again, the point is, he was tested and he's come out on top. He hasn't fallen into the trap. The next trap is in the next verse 18, and this time it's another group of people. And this time it's the Sadducees. So they're all having a go at him. Okay. And this is not a political thing, not an economic thing or a thing about Caesar. This is about theology. Because as it says, and we probably know, the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection or indeed any kind of afterlife. They didn't believe in angels, miracles, all the sort of spiritual side of it. They were a completely different brand of Jewish group, religious group, if you like. So they come to him to test him with another question, and this time it's on their pet subject of resurrection. There isn't one. And so they make up this highly contrived story about a woman marrying seven brothers in turn and ending up losing them all prematurely with no children, so that they can then test Jesus on, well, Moses' law says this, you've got to marry in order to, keep the family line. But in the end, none of it's worked. So what's going to happen in the resurrection then? She can't have seven husbands, can she? So what's going to happen there? And I love Jesus' reply in this. You're in error because you don't know the scriptures or the power of God. I really would love to keep saying that to lots of people every time that to say various things. You're in error because you don't know the scriptures or the power of God. And he answers the question in, again, a very interesting sort of way. Firstly, he points out that in the resurrection, there isn't going to be a marriage. It's not going to be the same anyway. So don't bring this highly hypothetical situation into that. And then he adds something extra, which is where his great sort of understanding and skills of these things coming in. He refers to Abraham, Isaac, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because God is the God of the living, not of the dead. So if God is the God of the living, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have died, but they must somewhere still be alive, and they must one day be part of the afterlife, whatever they wanted to think about on that, because God has still got promises to fulfill for them and things that they want. And the thing I noticed, that, I don't think it's in the Mark version, it must be in one of the others, that by the time Jesus has done his, you're in error, you don't have a clue what you're talking about, and you're just not familiar enough with God, you're badly mistaken, the Pharisees are rubbing their hands, delighted that he's put the Sadducees in their place, and the Sadducees slink off, silent and defeated. Another win for Jesus, so to speak. And the next little test, it follows straight on in Mark here, is verse 28. One of the teachers of the law now come up and say, basically, again, another test question, but this time a Pharisaic question on the law, which is the most important of all the commandments? And that was always a test question for every single rabbi. They would be asked this. Okay, teachers, tell us what is the best, most important commandment. And different people came up with different answers, some about living by faith, some by walking humbly before God. And you can get them all out of the scriptures. But in this case, Jesus has like quoted the number one answer, the classic, that most people sort of wanted to hear, which is the reference to loving the Lord your God with everything you've got. But he also adds an extra sort of rider to that, and don't forget to love your neighbor as yourself as well. And it says in verse 34, from that point onwards, no one dared ask him any more questions. Basically, every time they tried to trip him up with a question about this, question about that, he had come through, shall we say, unscathed. And therefore, this element of his testing, he still remained spotless and so on. So that's what you find in these few days, as well as other things coming up. These four occasions when every single religious group and political group have come to him and tried to trap him or test him, and they haven't succeeded. Now, I did say we wanted to get through to the end of chapter 13. So let's now go back and see if there's anything in the other parts of chapter 11 and 12 that we've skipped over you want to talk about. And then, of course, you get chapter 13, which is one of the end time discourses. So we'll try and do those in the remaining half an hour. So I'll be quiet for a couple of minutes while you pick up anything. So just come in with anything when you're ready. You can still read on as well in anything. But the moment you think of something that you want to comment on, then let's have it straight away. John?
The fig tree.
Yeah, what do you want to say then?
Well, it was killed from the roots up.
Oh.
So it was quite drastic.
Yeah. That's a good detail. That's verse 20, isn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, I lost it. But yeah, it's quite drastic, because, well, okay, a little bit like perhaps the worm with Jonah, but yeah. but nonetheless, it was from the roots. Whereas most things have a tendency to die from the top before they get to the root. But because often you talk about, you know, if you cut down a tree, I'm sure it says elsewhere in the Bible, you cut down a tree and it will resprout once it's seen some water.
Yeah,
Job talks about that. So it's it's a complete destruction.
Yeah,
there's no, with the root dead, there's no hope.
Yeah, and therefore it appears to be not just a natural thing that's happened, but it's directly because of the cursing. Yeah,
and of course the fig tree symbolizes Israel. So,
well, it can do.
Can do. Yeah.
I'm not going to say that every time you read about a fig tree in the Bible, it has to be Israel. If you want to make your own sort of deduction from that, fine. I just noticed that it's the next day as they're leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. So it looks like he hadn't been given his breakfast before he set off. If I can be a little bit cheeky about things again. But anyway, so it's the next day, which we could be now the Monday, unless he came in on the Monday and it's the Tuesday. But anyway, so it's probably early and he's on his way to the into the temple area. And people often comment upon the fact about these figs, because it says somewhere it's not the season for figs. So why did he expect to find figs and so on? Anyone got any thoughts on that? Heard anything about the nature of fig trees and why Jesus could perhaps be disappointed? Have you heard the fact that they produce figs twice a year? You're getting the initial small figs, which are not really the ones you want to eat, but that's not the main season for figs. But if there are no figs at that point, then it means there's not going to be the main ones in whatever month's time it is. So when he finds that nothing but leaves, he's not being harsh, because it should be had. If it's not the season, it's not the season for figs, why is he expecting to find any? Because you would expect to see signs that there would be, and so on. But it when he curses it, whatever that means, it doesn't die immediately. They don't find that out until the next morning, because by the time you get to verse 19, Jesus and his disciples leave the city again, go back to Bethany. So in the next morning, now it's the Tuesday or the Wednesday, as they go along, that's when they see that it's been withered. So Peter remembers it and says, oh, look, what happened. And Jesus then comments upon this. And this is where I'd be reluctant to say that he's referring in any way to Israel, unless Jesus makes that clear in what he says. So his teaching that follows from it is, I suppose, in some way sort of related to what they've just seen. But he's trying to teach them about faith and prayer, really, on the basis of that. He's not saying at this point, oh, the kingdom is going to be taken away from these people and given to someone else, or something like that. But it's one of the puzzling incidents why Jesus decides to do this at this point. Anything else so far in the chapters 11 and 12?
In 11:17, my house will be called a house of prayer,
yeah,
for all nations, which is, there's a reference in Isaiah 56, a prophetic reference. And I've just been through reading through the Bible again, and the tabernacle, which was the precursor to the temple. And I mean, it was just incredible. You know, if you went anywhere near it, you'd be dead, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the standards for the temple were incredible. And I'm not quite sure if this is a reference to the future where all nations will come to Jerusalem, or well, it's something else.
Yeah, you would have to put it back into the full context of that chapter in Isaiah. Mm-hmm. So Jesus is doing here what I've said many times he does. He quotes a tiny little fragment from somewhere, and you notice that he goes on to immediately say another little fragment from Jeremiah. Okay, the den of robbers one is from Jeremiah 7. Mm-hmm. So he's actually bringing two unrelated scriptures together to make the general point, but both of them need their full context. So I think, yes, in Isaiah's time, it was something prophetic about the future, but by the time you get to Herod's temple, there is meant to be a court of the Gentiles.
Okay.
And in fact, all the problems with the money changers and the selling of stuff would be noticeable to any Gentile that was around. So it was what we'd say today is it's bringing Judaism into disrepute. Mm-hmm. Okay. And yes, there might be an even further future thing that one day, you know, if there's going to be a temple again when we are all there, in the millennium or whatever. But Jesus is concerned at this point that the Jews are not honouring the fact that it is God's house. And a house of prayer for all nations might be so that Jews can pray for the other nations as well. You know, there's all sorts of aspects of this. But he's actually saying what's going on there, which, of course, he dealt with. He looked around, didn't he? That's right. He looked around the previous day, which is always interesting. He must have been very angry when he first got there and looked around, but he went away and slept on it. Then he came back and took action. Mm-hmm. There's a lot in that verse because of the two things that he quotes. Okay, so can I just promote again my website, where I've done a whole series on listening to the Jewish Jesus, and this sort of verse I go into in detail. Mm-hmm. And the book will be out in a couple of months, so you can even go through it all again. I found all these times when Jesus hints at something like this and what people would make of it, because when the chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, they're picking stuff up from everything that Jesus is saying at this point. We've just got a nice little quote, house of prayer for all nations and so on. It meant a huge lot more for them because they knew the context of Isaiah. They knew the context of Jeremiah, which was a big context. And therefore they knew that he was condemning them at the same time. Yeah. Jan, is that?
Yeah, we reckon that Jesus was amazed to see the money changers in the temple court, but surely he would have seen them every year when he went up.
Yeah, I'm sure he would. When you say amazed, is that somewhere in the text?
No, just what we just said. Okay. That he was shocked sort of seeing it.
I mean, yes, he would. Why hadn't he done anything? But, well, actually, it's interesting. In John's Gospel, it's put much earlier, and people debate whether it's the same event that's just recorded in different places or whether he did it the first time he went and then again at the end. But because this is now the end, you know, this he knows he's there for the last time. If he's going to do anything like this, it's got to be now, and maybe therefore in before he didn't bother, but now he always did what the Father told him to do. So maybe the pastor God said, just let it go for now, you like. But this time, no, you go for it. John, Rose?
Does this not relate to the house being thoroughly clean? I mean, Scripture says that the family should be sure there is absolutely no leaven in the house. These days they do a thorough spring clean before
Israel. Leading up to Passover and unleavened bread. Yeah, okay, maybe he is doing something like that, yeah. Interestingly, in that verse in Corinthians where Paul says, for Christ our Passover lamb has been sacrificed, sort of the bit we know, the verse before and the verse after, he talks about leavened and unleavened bread, because he knows the setting of the Passover is within that. And for us spiritually, he says, get rid of the old leaven of malice and wickedness, and have the new unleavened bread of sincerity and truth or something. So Paul is applying that to our personal lives to clear out the leaven there, because leaven did mean sinfulness in individual lives, like when Jesus refers to the leaven of the Pharisees and so on. So, yeah. What else have we got in these bits? We've got a fairly well-known parable, which again, not surprising that Jesus is going to say this sort of thing at this time. You know, as the chief priests, the elders, teachers of the law, and so on, know he's spoken the parable against them. They're looking for a way to arrest him, but they're afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. Sort of things are very much tension-wise, very, very high at this point, but nothing's going to happen until it's the right moment in the week, the right moment of the whole Passover scenario that Jesus is now very much caught up in. John?
I'm thinking, is there not a similar parable in Isaiah in relation to vineyard and stuff.
There is. The opening of this parable by Jesus is very reminiscent. I think it's Isaiah chapter 5, the Song of the Vineyard. And the Song of the Vineyard, prophetically, is about God saying, I did all this, I did all that, I set the whole thing up, I looked for fruit and I didn't get it. What more could I have done? Again, this is another talk or chapter in the book on what the Jewish Jesus was saying, because I think it's this one. Yeah, I mean, the opening of the parable certainly relates back to that chapter and so on. That's right. So verse 9, what then will the owner of the vineyard do? Jesus typically asks them a question, because they know the answer from Isaiah. What did God do in that vineyard? He systematically destroyed it because they weren't producing fruit for him. So, and Jesus follows it up with the famous quote about the cornerstone and so on. But the point is, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, the elders, knew he had spoken the parable against them. He's not speaking against the people generally here. He's always going to blame the leaders for the way things are gone. And it's one of his more powerful parables, really, because like all of them, they've got these twists in them, these shocks in them. In the end, he sends his son. Why on earth does the father send his son, knowing what they've just done to all his servants? I mean, he's sending him to his death, isn't he? And the father says, they'll respect my son. Wonder why he thinks that. The very opposite, the tenants think, kill him and we've got everything. But that's silly as well. Surely they would have realized the consequences of killing the son. You know, at this point, they're not thinking straight either. So there's all sorts of different things swirling around in that. Did they really think that they would inherit the vineyard if they killed the heir, the son? Somehow they thought that, but they shouldn't really have thought that. So. So there's one of the small incidents in this chapter, but perhaps in the last bit, we ought to look at chapter 13. Now, chapter 13 is Jesus's Olivet Discourse, as it's often called, the time when he spends time with his disciples and starts to teach them about things that are still to come. And you get the equivalent in Matthew 24, isn't it? 24 and 25. And it's there in Luke, I think, chapter 21. And I always find it interesting that Jesus didn't deliver all this end time stuff until his very last day or two with them. This wasn't what they needed to know from the very beginning. They needed to know lots of other things. But before he left them, he seems to make sure that they've had this little lecture on what's going to happen. But it starts off, doesn't it, with because again, every day they're going backwards and forwards from the temple area to Bethany. So this is a day when they're leaving the temple area, whether they've got very far. Well, they have, because eventually he sits on the Mount of Olives. So they're sort of halfway home, but he pauses. And that means they'll be looking back over the temple area. So maybe they're just having a rest there. But they said, basically, wow, isn't this great, this wonderful temple, these great big stones and how wonderful it's all built and so on. And Jesus completely shocks them by saying, one day it won't be there at all. Every stone will be thrown down. Now, we don't quite know what their immediate reaction is to that, but that would have shocked them. And the only way they could have comprehended that is to think, basically, that must be the end of the world. Or at least the end of the world as we know it. So they're trying to process that prediction of Jesus, because they don't know about AD 70 and the Romans and so on. Their only way of thinking is, basically, it says here, when will these things happen? What will be the sign? But I think it's in Matthew, It's about Jesus coming back. The question's a bit more direct about it being sort of, this is the time when Messiah will have to come. Now they know he's the Messiah. They're trying to get him to say more about this on the basis of this must be to do with when he returns and so on. And Jesus delivers a strange sort of concoction of teaching, really, where you can't say he particularly answers this question or that question in a nice sort of 1-2-3 order. He's not really giving a nice British-based sermon of 3 points where number one answers this, number two answers that. He takes them very Hebraically through lots of different aspects of it, and hopes that they eventually sort of pick up the main points in this. So it's fairly similar to the ones, the chapters in Matthew. Obviously, there's a little bit, not a lot more in Matthew, is there? Matthew 24. Luke, again, is very similar. But you get all these various ingredients, some of which people debate and argue about repeatedly, about what that means there and when is that going to happen here and so on. And what he says at the end, well, verse 28, where you've got another fig tree, again, very typical that this is also applied to Israel. But Jesus doesn't say that at all. He's just basically saying, you understand from nature how close you are to something actually happening. So use that as an illustration of how you interpret the signs of the time. I don't know if you've had this explained to you before, but you know that summer is near. The Hebrew word for summer is related to the usual sort of consonant root setup, to the idea of judgment and ripeness. So the summer, the hot months, are the times when everything comes to a head and it leads to the harvest. So there are times when God used the analogy of summer with judgment or the final harvest and so on. So he's basically saying you can spot the signs in nature when you know that you're coming to the end of the season and so on. Make sure that you understand the signs that I've given you, because then you'll also know that it's near. Near, that, I mean, it's explained right at the door. Near doesn't mean, you know, still a little while to go. It's getting nearer. It means coming up next, now. Anyway, this is not a time to do a full eschatological sort of teaching on everything Jesus says here, but you might have got some comments or questions before we finish, because we are going to leave chapters 14, 15, and 16 to next time. Elizabeth?
Yeah, it was just that first quiet time you had. I've been reading in Luke when he approached Jerusalem and saw the city and he wept over it.
Yeah.
And said, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace.
Mm.
And now it is hidden from your eyes. And then it talks about the days will come when your enemies will come against you.
Yeah.
But it just struck me, you know, like sometimes you see things for the first time, and that weeping over Jerusalem and him saying that, I found quite moving.
And I think it's only in Luke. But it links in a little bit later on, because if you remember, when Jesus is carrying his cross, there's all the daughters of Jerusalem, as they're called, the women weeping and wailing. And he says, don't weep for me, weep for yourselves, because of the judgment coming upon you.
Mm.
And he has already wept for Jerusalem with the judgment coming upon them. So he's almost telling them to join him in that kind of weeping, not because he is on his way to the cross. So, but yeah, you're right. The little verses where there's emotions attached, if we're not careful, we just read it and put it to one side. We don't think through what was really going on there. It's probably the sort of weeping which is really deep. I don't know what the words actually are mean in detail, but I don't think it was just a little sob for a couple of minutes. He was probably heartbroken over it.
Yeah, and I actually, when I went to Israel the first time, I was on the Mount of Olives, and I started crying for some for no known reason. I just started weeping. So
it might be, and I'm not an expert on this, but when you weep like that, you're probably interceding. You don't quite know why, but the spirit within you is actually doing the grieving, and it's just coming out of your eyes. But you probably just tapped into something of what God was feeling at the time, because he knows exactly what's going to happen and so on. Mary again.
I would just like to ask what it means regarding the fig tree, and Jesus says, "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." Do you think that means?
I've heard many sort of varieties on that. Particularly, it doesn't say it in this particular case, but sometimes you get a footnote to it. And sometimes you're told that generation can mean race, as in a race of people. And therefore, he's saying there'll always be Jews around until. So, that doesn't quite fit. It's a nice idea. It almost fits, but I'm told that it doesn't quite fit. The problem is some people think he's referring to the current generation that he's with at the moment, and of course they did pass away. At least all these things, if all these things that are happening is referring to AD 70, then it would happen within the generation that he is talking to at that point, because we're still 30, 40 years away. But if he's talking about things in the very end time, then that current generation have passed away, and he does say until all these things have happened, and presumably all these things go right the way back to everything he's talked about, including the time when the Son of Man comes in the clouds and so on, because effectively he stopped teaching them at verse 27 about his return, and then verse 28 he adds a little what you might call a parable, was it a lesson, a little bit extra, not to tell them more about the future, but to tell them to, be more aware and alert for this sort of thing. So in the end, my best understanding of this, it's tied up in this little word, this generation, because there's always an ambiguity about this, which is this one. Or actually you could justify this linguistically, you could replace it with the word that. So when you say this generation, it doesn't have to be this one here and now. It's this generation at that time, the generation that will be around when these things start to happen will be the same generation in which they will end. In other words, he's giving a prediction that once these things start, and you'd have to sort of go back to where he's first talked about things like maybe the abomination of desolation or rumours of wars or whatever. He's saying the generation that is there at that time, this generation will not pass away until all things have happened. He's sort of predicting that once it gets going, it will happen very quickly. The days will be short, probably just a few years. So although you might think you're sort of twisting the language a little bit by this generation, but you can use the word this not to mean the one immediately you've got here, but the one you've been talking about all along. So at a certain time, that's going to happen, that's going to happen. And this generation that sees that will see it through to the end. It's not going to drag on past 30, 40 years and so on. To me, that's slightly better than assuming that he is talking to the people of his own generation and he's referring to AD 70, which clearly doesn't fit, or he's talking to this generation about things in the future and Jesus got his timing wrong, or it really means race, which it sort of doesn't quite, and he's talking about the Jewish people generally. But there we are. I've given you all the different options and I've told you what I tend to think, and as always, we leave it like that. And
I try
not to be anymore.
That's helpful. Thank you.
That's the explanation I've heard.
Say that again. So who was that?
Well, I think that's the best explanation of this generation I've heard. Yeah.
I have, when I look at this thing, I check out the best I can that the word this, and by the word, I'm not necessarily meaning the Greek, I'm meaning what Jesus might have said in Hebrew behind it. Equally, it's the same word that could be used for that. And the translator has come up with one option rather than another, whatever reason they do. So it is a valid retranslation of a single word or re-understanding of a certain word.
I've heard that quite a few people say that from when Israel became a nation in 1948.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There won't be a generation that passes away, and people speculate, or from 67 when they got Jerusalem, but then they say, well, what is a generation? Is it 70 years? Is it?
I know.
You've probably heard that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. We had all the different. Yeah. People got very excited from 1948 onwards, started counting a generation. People then were looking for something to happen in 1988. Because that's 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think when that didn't happen, they had to redefine generation to mean 70 years, could it be? There's only one part of scripture where the word generation is defined in terms of a number of years, which is rather surprising because it's 100 years, because it talks about in the fourth generation and 400 years later. But that's the only place, and I'm not trying to say that's what the word generation must always mean, that huge amount of time, because maybe 2048 is going to be significant, I don't know. But I absolutely right that at the time I had all these prophecies and speculations about what's going to happen in a generation's time, with lots of people being disappointed when it didn't meet their particular time scale, which is the usual warning, just be careful about that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's idea of this generation being then is because it's assumed that in verse 28, the fig tree represents Israel, and the fig tree with its tender twigs and leaves coming out must refer to 1948. Again, I think that's reading something into the scripture, because I don't think Jesus was even thinking about 1948 at that point, or its equivalent. And he's just saying, learn the lesson of the fig tree. The fig tree lets you know when something is happening, when you get into the end of summer. Now, maybe you can apply it to Israel, but I've always said, be careful about fig trees, because sometimes fig trees are just fig trees. They're not always Israel, any more than olives and trees and vines and so on, which can be used symbolically of Israel. And then you get people giving great long things on the fig tree refers to this aspect of Israel, whereas the vine refers to that aspect of Israel, and the olive tree that aspect of Israel. So you've now got to know what all three of them mean, that one is sort of political Israel, one is religious Israel or whatever. And I just think, okay, you're getting too complicated for me there. But I say be careful about making too much of fig trees. Sometimes you can turn them into a figment of your imagination. And that's my usual little jokey stuff.
But I think it's significant that Israel became a nation, though. That's a significant thing.
Absolutely.
I
don't think you can necessarily say Jesus is predicting it here and then make deductions from it for the next bit. I just want to take it as a simple sort of thing. How would they have understood it? Oh, here's a lesson from Jesus about the signs of the times as they knew them, you know. They know when fig trees leaves come out. They know what that means in terms of summer. They understood from the prophets that Jesus used the idea of summer to mean ripe for judgment. Think of Amos giving him a vision. What do you see, Amos? I see a basket of summer fruits, he says. What does that mean? Oh, it means time is ripe. It's now ripe for my people Israel. And that was a prophecy about the forthcoming destruction of Israel in Amos's time. So, but this is just a little lesson from nature. And basically, he's saying, he's given them all these signs in advance, but he says, the time will come when you will really know that it's going to happen. But I don't think it's necessarily in their generation. He's not specifying then which particular generation will be around. He's not trying to date things, of course. Right, I think we've done pretty well what I hoped to do. Going quite nicely through the first three chapters of this last bit. So, we want to read ahead. Obviously, there's three more chapters to go. I will certainly talk about the trial, and again, putting it into the context of all the Gospels, because if I asked you to give me a sort of complete outline of the trial, you might think, I'm not sure quite what happened there and what happened next and so on. But there's six elements to the trial of Jesus to look at, including another lot of mistreatment in a way that the Passover lamb was not meant to be treated. And again, Jesus coming through, I think it might have been Mary at the beginning, was already hinting at this, that the whole trial and all the different things that went along with that was another final sort of test of Jesus' character. And then we'll see what we have to say perhaps about the resurrection and one or two things about that, just to make sure we've got a proper biblical understanding of the resurrection and not some of the other strange things that people sometimes talk about or indeed are put into songs. I'm not saying, you know, that most of the resurrection songs are not worth it, but sometimes I'm quite wondering if they've actually read the scriptures properly before they've written the songs that they have. But as I'm being recorded, I won't go any further on that one moment. But Maureen, you might want to say something before we switch off the recording.
I was only thinking about Jesus saying that only the Father knows.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the fig tree may not, I'm just thinking, maybe it doesn't mean about when you know, the time.
No, it's a general sign from nature of, it's an illustration of something, if you like. It's a lesson. Now learn the lesson of, here's a parable for you. Here's another little illustration. You understand that. So now apply that in terms of that sort of thing, rather than trying to make something of every single leaf or twig of a fig tree. So, yeah. But, yeah, the Father is the only one that knows. I always ask this sort of question without having any answer. It's speculation. I wonder if Jesus now knows when he's coming back, or is he still waiting for the Father to tell him? You know, is it a date on a calendar that Jesus is sitting there waiting, sitting in heaven, waiting for? Or is he with the Father saying, do you think we're getting there yet? There's a bit more to go. And the Father says, I'll tell you. I'll let you know. But it'll be the right time, won't it?
Yeah. So.
Okay, let's switch off the recording, shall we then, Christine? Thank you.
Yep.